this week. Here comes a bride. Here comes a bride. And her director, yes, is Jessie Buckley, star of The Bride, and that film's director, Maggie Gyllenhaal. All that, plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that has, apparently, at last count, over 50, yes, 50, on this podcast. No more. No more running gags on this podcast. We are full up. Thank you very much. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Improv Podcast. This week, I'm in the pod booth joined by three, count them, three colleagues of such lethal cunning that is technically running gag number one. Who are we joined by? We're joined by geek queen Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. We are joined by God Free himself. Alex Godfrey is here. Hello.
Hi.
What was that?
Oh, it was my voice saying hi. Happy.
But why were you so high-pitched?
And I don't, probably because
like a squeaky schoolboy.
I'm feeling a bit strange because, as you saw 15 minutes ago, I just started a big lunch.
You did.
And your face, when you came into the office and you were like, okay.
That's going to take some time to shift.
Well, it didn't, but now I don't feel very well.
Amazing. But you ate quickly, Alex, but you didn't eat as quickly as the person to your right. He was known, of course, as the Camino Kid.
No, he wasn't.
Tin Chim.
Again, no.
What was the one last week?
No.
What was the one last week?
No.
Can't remember it anyway. Doesn't matter. He is in dire need,
oh boy,
of a new nickname. And that nickname this week will be provided for him via Blue Sky. His real name in Earth language is James Dyer. Hello, James.
Hello, Chris.
Do you want to know what your nickname is this week, James?
No.
It is too late. We've had a number of entries. Here is one, this week's nickname, from Hoyless, Phil Hoyle on Blue Sky. I was listening to the podcast, thank you, and heard that James is rarely in on Tuesdays, so his nickname should be Chew Slacker, rhyme with Chewbacca.
I was 100% sure it was going to go on the See You Next Tuesday route.
Explain.
Because, you know, I'm a person who doesn't work on Tuesday.
Okay. Good, good. No, he didn't, because our listeners are lovely people, unlike the people who make this podcast.
Yeah.
So hey. they would never, there are some exceptions, of course, so they would never go there. Are you happy with Chew Slacker?
Obviously not. It's terrible. Genuinely, genuinely terrible.
For sure. It would be Chewy.
Chewy. Tooey.
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 No.
You could provide holidays at great prices. Do you provide holidays at great prices, James Dyer?
Other holiday agents.
All right.
I mean, can't call me Lun Polly either.
Chew Slacker has spoken. He does not like it. We're gonna give it a go, the Endless Podcast, see if it sticks, but I don't think it's going to stick. So if it doesn't stick, please do send in your suggestions for James's nickname to me on whatever social media platform you can think of. I'm pretty much going to be on it. So let's see what happens. But yes, this running gag thing. Or it's not running gags, but certainly a list of someone on our subreddit has put together a list of all the long-term references and running gags that we do on this podcast. And at the last count, they've got up to 51.
I like that thread. I thought it was really useful. And frankly, some of the jokes on there, I was like, is it interesting? I'd actually forgotten where half of this shit had come from. So I think that was a really nice primer for people joining the podcast. I think it should be required reading.
A bit of homework.
I don't think it should be required. And I think maybe 50 is too many, but you know.
Helen, are you accusing us of beating jokes to death?
I think a 50 is not enough.
Wow, okay.
Especially for a podcast that is entering its 15th year. That's only just over 3 and a bit running gags per year. So we've actually been slacking, if anything.
I don't think so. I think we've probably retired some, at least, that needed to be retired, I devoutly hope.
They can always come back, Helen.
They can always come back. For a lot of people, for example, were saying that they really like my Peter Lorre impression. But
I have
retired that out of respect to Helen. It repulses Helen on a near physical level.
Actual
physical level. And so I wouldn't do it.
The one that I have embraced so wholeheartedly, both on mic and off, is the Thor meme.
Is it that?
That's the one. Which has become an indelible part of my everyday vernacular. I can't not do that now. It's almost Pavlovian. It's a part of me.
Pavlova. Yeah, that's a good
one. That's never getting retired. I'm so sorry.
I like that. You know what? I was looking at this and I was thinking, are there too many? And I'm looking at it and going, no, they're all good. So I'm actually going to try and cram all 51 into this podcast.
Oh,
wow. For the next hour or so.
Consciously or unconsciously?
I wonder if it is going to be consciously. I actually have retired that.
Good.
I've made a real effort over the last 6 or 7 minutes to not do Khonshu.
Yeah.
Every time someone says Khonshu.
That's when I'm happy to see the back up.
Oh, I'm not. I'm bringing it back with a fucking vengeance. But anyway.
Twice already in the past 5 minutes, you said I have retired that, which is becoming a running gag.
We're now at 52. Anyway, shall we have a question?
Yes, let's.
Shall we do it? All right, so I've asked for the question to come from this week, the Empire Podcast subreddit, which is on Reddit, which is a kind of reward for their efforts in putting together that epic list of our in-jokes and running gags and long-term references, many of which have been retired, but some of which have not been. The one that has caught my eye is from yellow_barchetta, who says, Mother's Day is coming up soon. Now, technically, it's next week, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 15th. This Sunday is what? The
8th, International Women's Day.
There you go. This is perfect. It all works out.
Is it? Okay.
International Women's Day, and then followed a week later by Mother's Day.
Yes, indeed.
And then Oscar.
Wow. What a time to be alive.
What a time to be Jesse Buckley.
Yeah. So in recognition of Mother's Day, it's a bit early, but we'll take it anyway. Mother's Day is coming up soon, says yellow_barchetta. If you had to swap your own... Now I've read it out loud. This question has flaws. If you had to swap your own dearly beloved mother for a film mother, who would you want to have been raised by?
The computer from Alien.
Obviously, none of the mothers on film could match my own mother. Let's just get that out of the way.
I agree.
Are you sure?
I met her. She was delightful.
Yeah.
And still is.
Thank you.
She's very nice, but let's not get carried away.
I mean, well, she could definitely beat the mum in carry.
I mean, your mummy is no Lee Cronin's The Mummy. Just saying.
No. And that is one of many marks in her favour.
Would you like to be raised by Imhotep?
I would not.
An Imhotep mother.
And I think having the mummy as your mother might really confuse you. I think that would lead to all sorts of unwanted feelings.
Yes. See, James, I might have worked if you'd gone Imhotep mother, but I had to work it out.
I see.
But,
sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Should have spoon-fed that one a little bit more.
Yes, I think you should have done. We're not adding that to the list. So let me see. This, weirdly enough, is a question that wounds me. It wounds me.
Oh, no.
Because we're coming up, we're very, very close to the 20th anniversary of my mum's death. So I don't have a mum. And thank you, yellow_barchetta, for reminding me of that fact. I'd forgotten. I'd finally got over it. And now, here it is.
How are you the monster in this situation? But somehow you are, Chris.
I've been wronged. What? I've been wounded.
You should have really ticked the box saying, I would rather not hear questions about my dearly departed mother, shouldn't you?
Well, technically it's not about my mum, but it is asking if you could swap your mum for a film mother, who would you want to have been raised by? I think someone with a lot of money. Right?
The parents in Richie Rich kind of a thing.
Do you think?
Well, I mean, yes, they're negligent and get them go away for a trip and then get, I think, wasn't it, you know, shipwrecked or plane wrecked on a desert island. But they are basically caring. The only thing is that they have wildly spoiled their son. Like, wildly.
I must confess, I haven't seen Richie Rich.
I mean, you're not missing a huge amount, but I'm just saying, like, if you want lots of money, then that mother would qualify.
But is it a good mum?
Oh, yeah, she loves her kids, yeah.
She goes away for a bit.
She just gets shipwrecked on a desert island slightly.
Okay, all right.
Slightly.
I mean, yeah.
Slightly.
How does one get slightly shipwrecked?
You know, for a while, but not permanently.
Like, are we talking Chuck Nolan shipwrecked? Are we talking Linda Little shipwrecked?
More Linda
Robinson
Little,
Robinson Crusoe shipwrecked? What are we talking?
I think more Linda Little. Yeah. And because they come back in, I think, a matter of months rather than years, or weeks rather than months.
And meantime, this mewling brat of a child, this Richard Culkin. Rich.
Yes. I'm right here.
He is what, spending their... Is this like Brewster's Millions, but with kids?
A little What's bit. What's going on? He's not going crazy with the money. He's, of course, seeing off schemes by baddies.
Of course he is.
I don't remember the film well, but you said you wanted a rich mother.
Yeah, but I don't want the richy rich mother.
Well... Okay,
I want a mother who's going to be around for her kids. I want a mother who is into culture. I want a mother who might go to the opera every now and again. I want a mother who wears a nice pearl necklace. I want Martha Wayne, is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
I mean, a mother who's going to stick around.
Until you got to the pearl necklace part, and that one, by the way, of course, is famously cheap.
What?
Because it all comes apart when it's... Real pearls are strung individually and knotted individually. If a pearl necklace explodes like that, it was cheap pearls that were just put on a string.
This is good information.
Mm-hmm.
What if...
Wayne has been shortchanging his wife.
Do you think he was having an affair?
100%. He gave the real pearl necklace, stop it, to
See, I'm glad I wasn't the first person to mention that.
Not in a sex way. There we go. That's one of
them. The right answer, I think, fulfilling almost all of your criteria, is Morticia Adams.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Explain.
Well, she might give you confusing feelings again about how you're supposed to feel about your mum, but
Why?
She's very loving, she's cultured, she is supportive of her children's interests.
Uh-huh.
She models a happy and committed marriage.
She's always well-lit.
She's always exceptionally she's always well-lit. She's incredibly well-dressed.
Yeah. Is she, though?
And she's always present.
Okay.
Yeah.
Black never goes out of style.
Mm. Chic.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. I want Martha Wayne. Martha Wayne, because when she shuffles off this mortal coil...
You'll become Batman.
No. I think that's
his logic.
Yes. I think it's unlikely that I would become Batman.
I'd love to see it.
Should we give it a go? Yeah. But I think I would benefit from the money that they would leave me in their will.
But the Adams are also super rich.
By the way, that's a lovely sentiment for Mother's Day in International Women's
Day. I would like the woman to die and make me rich. Wow.
Well, I'm just thinking, because my mum is no longer with us, so what if I replaced her with a mother? So I don't want to get too attached, right? Because I've been through that pain once before. Okay. I don't want to have that pain again. So what if we would replace... Yeah, A, I should get some money out of it, but B, I should have someone who's not going to be long for this world, so that therefore, like 2-3 weeks max.
Wow.
So my mum's gone, and then she gets swapped out for Martha Wayne. Mm-hmm. Martha Wayne goes to the theater or whatever it is one night. Boom. Along comes Joe Chill or Jack Napier, depending on what you're watching. And there you go. Kerching, Chris is in major coin. I'm excited about this. I'm going for Martha Wayne.
It's very sweet.
Alex. Alex, have you had time to think? As a mother yourself, yes. have you had time to think about this?
My thoughts immediately turned, as they often do, to Dot Cotton. She's not from she's not from the movies, but she loved her son so much she bought heroin for him. But I digress.
Yeah.
Recently, I think she wasn't very well, but Jodie Comer was a very good mother in 28 years later, was she not?
Mm. She's also a very good mother in The End We Start From.
Yes, she's very maternal.
Mm.
She'd do anything with the kids. Beloved, actually.
Well, maybe not in Star Wars The Force Awakens, where she abandons her child on a planet.
She abandoned her boy!
That is a deep dive. talking of Morticia Adams, Angelica Houston in The Royal Tenenbaums, solid.
Mm-hmm.
Solid.
Okay.
Keeping that family together.
Yeah, but they're not well adjusted.
No, but
are they?
She's a loving mother. I'm not well adjusted, but my mum's nice.
Okay, fair enough. I don't want to blame her.
Very slightly confused in a midlife crisis-y sort of way, but Rachel McAdams in Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, recently. Oh, she was a lovely mother.
She's lovely.
She was a lovely mother. And also in I Swear, Maxine Peake, not playing John Davison's birth mother, but taking him under his wing and being a very, very, very good mother and allowing him to become his full self and blossom was very nice.
And what would they bring to the table that your own mother doesn't?
Do you mean financially?
I just mean however... this is how I saw the question. I saw a chance
now,
to make
on.
Bank.
Now, hang on.
You could see a chance to make emotional bank.
No, but listen, this is... I don't think my mum listens to this podcast, but I thought the question was if.
No, if you had to swap.
Yes, no, if you had to. Saying, why are they better? Your question is, why are these people better than my actual mum?
Why would you want to have been raised by them?
How about Patricia Clarkson and Easy A?
How about Patricia Clarkson and Easy A?
Well, there you go.
But that would mean also that Tooch is my dad.
I know.
Oh my God.
It's a win-win.
All right. Do I have to fight you now for for Clarkson the Tooch? Clarkson the Tooch?
Clarkson the Tooch.
Clarkson the Tooch.
I don't think my mum would buy me heroin.
Have you asked?
How is this can your measure of heroin?
Can you text your mum now and ask her?
No. You know what? If I did text like for lols, yeah, she would just be very confused by the question. There's no context. Would you buy me heroin?
Oh yes, hey mom, would you buy me some heroin?
I would add the word hypothetically.
I would add the word please.
Chris, my friend Chris wants to know: would you buy me heroin?
Please. Oh, Alex called me his friend. That's nice.
No. You said hypothetically.
Usually I'm just colleague. Oh, that's
person
nice.
Person.
You're always my friend in this pod booth.
Oh,
for
thank
at
you.
Least 90 or 100
yes.
minutes.
Usually I'm either a person you've met or a person of interest.
Yes.
that's usually what I am.
Not interested.
All right, Jimbo.
Yes.
Is the alien queen, isn't it?
Shit. Look, she was maternal, she was loving, and when her children were all incinerated, she went on a rip-roaring rampage of revenge. So, yep. You know, that's motherhood.
It is motherhood.
Where'd you get the maternal bit from?
Well, because she wants to look after her little facehugger eggs.
Yeah. Ripley threatens the eggs.
That's right. And the queen's like, right, you're fucked.
Yeah.
Was probably going to eat them when they hatched, though.
Hey, that's not how they work.
Yeah, we have no evidence of that.
No, we have no evidence at all.
Evidence.
Ripley's obviously got good maternal instincts. So, yeah. You know, she goes into the hive to save Newt.
Yeah.
Newt. So, my name's Newt. Nobody calls me Rebecca except my brother.
What's in the brother's name?
Timmy.
Very good.
Timmy?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway.
Timmy Jordan, played by Carrie Henn's brother. The other thing I would say, if I had to pick a movie mum to actually raise and nurture me,
that's the point.
I'm thinking the alien queen might not give me the kind of love and affection that I really need.
Yep. What with being a different species,
right? Yeah. Indeed, and I don't think I would play well with my siblings, the face huggers. So I would say Molly Weasley would not be the worst choice.
Molly Weasley.
So I think she'd do a good job.
But really, you're talking book Molly Weasley, because film Molly Weasley, this is my ongoing issue with the final film. They fucked up her big moments and just soft-pedaled and soft-soaped her big duel with Bellatrix Lestrange, which should have been epic and was just...
Are you saying that David Yates didn't bring it home?
I'm saying in that respect, okay. I wasn't impressed.
Your Yates wine is lodged.
I'll be your mum, James.
That was better. that was good. There are 12 people who would get that joke.
I don't get it.
But I appreciate it. Yates Wine Lodge.
Oh, okay. It was worth it.
Yeah, it was very good. Very good.
It's improving by the second.
I really like that.
Like Yates Wine.
Yes.
Wine with an H, you see. Wine with an H.
Yeah, you know, famously, the best wine is Yates wine.
Yes, famously.
Comes from the Yates region of France.
It's named after the region, yeah.
Yes. Sparkling Yates, of course, is... Anyway. So is that it? Molly Weasley?
Yeah, I'm sticking with Molly Weasley.
Okay, that's a good choice.
Is this Mount Rushmore?
It's a Mount Rushmore of movies.
No, it's not a Mount Rushmore.
It's a Mum Rushmore.
It's a Mum Rushmore.
Mount Rushmum.
So who we got? The Alien Queen, Dot Cotton. Who else?
Would the Alien Queen buy heroin for her kid? Well, I think yes. Exactly.
Yeah, I think yes.
I'm not sure if she has pockets. She wouldn't have any money.
Of course she's got pockets.
I think she could obtain heroin for her kid if she needed.
Yeah. She's got a giant egg sack.
Well,
she could keep stuff in that, for sure.
Don't know that that's what it's for, but yeah.
So, Alex, your contribution has been Dot Cotton from EastEnders, in case people don't know who that is.
But also Dottie from I Swear.
Yeah,
so
Dot,
it's obviously
Dottie.
The name Dot that he considers essential.
Yeah, like Chris and Martha.
Martha! Martha, did you say that name? Say that name!
Oh my God.
Oh,
and Hell's Bells, you said. Remind me.
I don't remember. It was ages ago.
Imhotep, probably.
Yes.
All right. Well, there we go. I think we've exhausted all the possibilities
of
cinematic mums. And if you are a mum or have had a mum or are in the process of giving birth to several eggs that will then make way for face huggers that will then grow into xenomorphs that will then kill us all, then can I wish you a happy early Mother's Day. Shall we have a guest?
Let's
do it. Shall we have guests, in fact?
Ooh.
Ooh, that's right, guests, because this week sees release of The Bride! Exclamation mark, which is Maggie Gyllenhaal's second movie as director. She also wrote this one, and it reunites her with the star of her first movie, The Lost Daughter, Jessie Buckley, who is bound to win an Oscar. Oscar bound, I would say.
You got to stop tempting fate. If you mess up her Oscar, I'm going to be really cross.
It's not going to be because of me. But anyway, it's reunited with Jessie Buckley for a wildly ambitious take on the story of Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster and the Bride of Frankenstein. And it reimagines that in, 1930s America, and Christian Bale plays Frank, who is the creature who's now well over a century old, and he's lonely. He is so lonely. And he wants a mate. And so he approaches Annette Bening's scientist and says, can you make me a mate? And lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, just a few minutes later, along comes Jessie Buckley as the bride because she has recently been deceased.
No.
Yes, murderized, or at least manslaughterized. And they fall in love and they, wouldn't you know it, one thing leads to another. And before you know it, they're going across the country on a rampage of crime. And there's musical numbers and all sorts of stuff that greets them along the way. And I was delighted, I tell you, to sit down in a London hotel room with Maggie Gyllenhaal and Jessie Buckley just the other day. And we had a good old natter about this movie, about how John Mulaney didn't show up in the movie because he talked very publicly a couple of years ago about self-taping for this film, and a great many things besides. Do please enjoy. Maggie, Jessie, welcome to the Avra Podcast. How are you both?
Good, yeah.
Good. Excellent. Jessie, congratulations, by the way, on the BAFTA the other day. Not bad at all. I saw that you were in the reinvigoration station.
Yes.
Just next door. Maggie, have you been there yet?
I have, yeah.
Yeah? Okay. So you've seen the donuts that stain your teeth and lips.
One?
Not yet. No. I thought it would be unprofessional to do so before.
No, people are coming in having some black.
I've seen people going around with their lips and their chins.
I have a blackjack in my pocket, though. That'll stain your tongue.
That might do it, yeah.
Have you ever had one of these?
I remember
we were actually going to use these to try and stain our tongues black because we thought, how do we do this without getting black teeth?
We thought it would be so awful for you after a while to have to keep eating blackjacks.
Yeah,
probably. Yes. Absolutely. Well, I didn't want to do it for the interview, but I am going to do it afterwards. But also, you know, I'd rather have Nadia Stacey do it for me on a daily basis.
Than a donut.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know Nadia a little bit.
We
go back years, but this is an astonishing makeup job.
Yeah.
Can you talk about, Jessie, from your point of view, working with Nadia every day, and Maggie, you know, the design of the bride in this is extraordinary.
Well, yeah, Nadia is an incredible artist, you know, and really when we were creating the look of it, we tried out lots of things and we were really inspired by many, many kind of images, and we wanted something to look iconic and beautiful, but also monstrous. And what was going to be a kind of nod to Elsa Lancaster's world in a way, but something that was definitively ours. And Nadia, in her research, we were looking at like what happens when you get struck by an electrical bolt of lightning.
Yeah.
And you get these incredible patterns on your arm, like that almost look like kind of branches on a tree. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of instigated the idea that maybe from this reinvigoration, that the kind of ink is almost an expression of her expression that was kind of bursting out and creating tattoos on her.
Yeah.
And also maybe that the ink was like Mary Shelley's pet, from Mary Shelley's pen.
Yes.
You know?
That's a Jesse idea that I thought was so brilliant.
Yeah.
From the liquid of her pen.
Yeah.
And, you know, that also maybe that with the light that everything go completely bright white, like my eyelashes would be burned to white, eyebrows, every part of myself was bleached. I leave that for, that's it. I'm not going to say anymore. She did a great job. A thorough job, I would say.
And Maggie?
Well, I think, you know, I had two things in mind. One was, you know, Elsa Lanchester in the original movie is in it for 2 minutes and doesn't speak.
Yes.
I mean, she yells, but she doesn't say one word.
Yeah.
And yet her look, her vibe made a major cultural impression.
Yeah.
So we had that in mind, of course. We also wanted to make a cultural impression and have a look that was iconic. But I think for me, the way to get to that was totally through story. So, I don't know where this idea came from exactly, but, you know, she has that black stuff that goes into her veins. And then how will that translate itself to the outside? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are asking me, is her blood black? I actually don't think so. But it's this stuff that just keeps coming up. Her tongue is black because I imagine that stuff just keeps sort of coming up. Mm. And what is that stuff? You know, in a way, I also pictured it had like clogged her throat. And, you know, the very first thing that she does when she first gets up is like, is that cough of this black inky tar.
Yeah.
You know, she's kind of like clearing the way for something to come out. And then once it's cleared, there's no stopping her. You know, it's almost like a, I mean, look, if the original Bride of Frankenstein had no voice, had no words, that's a good place to start from, to talk about all the people who feel silenced, who have no words.
Yeah.
And this movie is for them, for us, you know? Yeah. So this woman comes and just clears her throat. All this stuff ends up marking her face, and then it's clear, and she can start to express herself.
Jesse, you play Mary Shelley as well as the bride, and that leads to some amazing moments where you're flitting back and forth between characters within the same physical space, of course. Mm-hmm. And what was that experience like for you? It was astonishing watching it.
It was like playing jazz, you know, like, but really good jazz. And in order to create it, like, I really had to kind of clarify who each of them were independently. And then over time, over a year-long prep, really begin to have a conversation with both of these women. Well, three women, really, inside of me.
Yeah.
And don't we all have a voice like Mary Shelley in our head that's kind of provoking us to tell the truth?
Oh, I don't. Like, there's nothing going on.
What do you really want to ask us? What do you really?
What's
unthinkable? Don't you dare. I'll unleash Mary Shelley onto you.
Jesus Christ. I got interviews over. I'm gone.
No, do dare.
Do dare.
We can take all
we
of
can
it.
We can take it, yeah. It was an epic challenge, but a really pleasurable one. And
I mean, it's wild.
Yeah, and I loved. I mean, the Mary Shelley actually that you see at the beginning. I was 8 months pregnant when I shot that, and I remember we were shooting it, and I was like, we both were like, "Whoa, I'm kind of monstrous right now. Like, I've got two heartbeats inside me. Like, I have my own creation that's bubbling." I knew I was having a daughter at the time. I was like, "I've got, you know, we're putting whatever I'm whispering out through the voice of Mary Shelley, I hope to pass on to this young woman that's going to step into the world in her own way." So that was really, really cool.
And Ramona was encouraging us too.
She was.
Yeah, my daughter,
It's amazing. Just watching those scenes, flitting back and forth is a hell of a thing. If I can ask any question, if the gloves are off, if we can go there.
Yes, come on.
The question I need to now have an answer to is, why did John Mulaney not get the role of young cop?
Here's what I will say to John Mulaney. I never got that tape. It's not was too it? Late. We can still cut him in. We could have two cops. No, it was, first of all, here's what I really want to say to John Mulaney. Okay. I thought that was fucking funny and yeah. I loved it. And young cop is actually a great part. Young cop is Louis Cancelmi's part.
Yes.
You know, he's got a whole lot it to
was,
do.
And he was so brilliant.
He was so brilliant. I agree.
Scene. One of
I
my
agree.
Favorite scenes I shot was that scene.
Oh, oh really? He was so
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. I loved it. It was brilliant.
But I never got a tape you from John Mulaney. And it's not too late, dude. Send it.
Do you think if he was gilding Lily somewhat? Maybe he wasn't.
I don't know. Or someone
gilded
didn't,
his Lily.
Someone didn't show it to me. I never got it. If it exists, I'd like to see it. I'd very much like to see it.
Who has buried this tape? I want to know. Powerful people don't want John Mulaney to be in this movie.
But also, it's a good part. It's a real part.
It's a fantastic part. Yeah. I think he just reacted to the character name, Young Cop.
I know. And you know what? Thanks to John Mulaney, truly, I named him. He's actually called Officer Goodman in the script.
That's amazing.
Thank you, John Mulaney.
That's amazing. Well, it's too late now, but it is a fantastic
Next
role.
Next time.
You know what? I think he would have been wrong for it.
Well, we'll never know, will we? I never got the tape.
I think he deleted the tape himself and just made up a bullshit story to cover up his tracks. That's what I think happened.
That's really what you want to ask us. Go deeper.
I want to know.
Bring up your inner Mary Shelley.
I want to know everything. But with this, I mean, I was just talking to Christian and he was being very complimentary about you, Maggie, you know, saying that you're swinging with the fences here. And this is a very, very bold swing of a movie. And getting a studio to back that in this day and age, in particular, must have been tricky. How did you go about it? What was your pitch like?
I mean, I worked very hard. You know, of course, I had to go in and pitch the movie and had tons of images and thoughts and ideas and, you know, kind of was explaining to them the cinematic language that we would be working in. Mm. But more than anything, I felt that studio understood what I was doing. Mm. And it was both Mike and Pam, Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdi, who run Warner Brothers, who I think are incredible partners, brave partners, but also maybe in particular, Pam. This is a story from a female director, from a feminine point of view, even though just like we are interested in movies made by men. I'm interested in men too. There's some very incredible men in this movie, I think. Yeah. But the perspective is new and is feminine. And I think she said, I see this movie and I see, I hear the beating heart in this movie. And someone quoted something to me recently, like 7% of the movies last year were made by women. More will be made when women also run the studios.
Yeah.
You know, and so it wasn't like a crazy uphill climb. I mean, I felt very, very supported all the way through the movie. I will say this, and I think this is interesting too. I set out on this movie to make a big pop roller coaster of a movie. Like I wondered, in the same way that in The Lost Daughter, which is a very small movie and almost like a chamber piece or like a poem or something in The Lost Daughter, but we were being very, very honest, like searingly honest about something that people don't really talk about. So I thought, could I do the same thing? Could I be searingly honest about the way I see the world, but do it in a pop big way? What would happen, you know? And so along the way, I really think Pam in particular helped me to stay on course with what my original intention was, which was to make a movie for many, many people. Like I wanted to make a movie for the monster, the little bit of monster that's in everybody.
Mm.
And sometimes she would say, you've tipped off the tightrope here. If you keep this scene in, you've alienated this group. And I think that's actually incredibly interesting and an incredibly interesting collaboration that Pam and I had together.
Did you keep it in? in the end?
Well, there were places where I was like, no way is this. Absolutely not. Like this, without this, the movie has a different DNA. And other places where I considered it and thought about it and even maybe initially went, no way in my head. Yeah. And then thought about it and went, no, she's right. If I'm trying to walk a tightrope of tone, this scene, it's true. It does. It pushes me off the tightrope. I got to let it go. And I think that's a kind of incredible collaboration to have with another person and with another woman.
I think I felt that from the minute I read the script because it was like a very, very new but very alive language and something that was totally from Maggie's mind. And I could feel her daring to stretch her limbs, you know, not just, it would have been so easy to do another film like Lost Daughter. Mm. And actually, that's not what we're in it for. Whereas we're artists that want to grow and expand and actually put ourselves into an unknowable place. And I think you can only do that with solid structure around you, with great collaborators and other people like Christian and Karen Murphy and Nadia Stacey and Sandy Powell and Pam Abdi. Like, you need strong structures to be able to be as wildly imaginative as you can possibly, you know, put yourself into a new landscape. And I felt I definitely felt the challenge of it when I read it. I had no idea how to even started, but you just have to start. And some of my footing at the beginning was like, not right, you know? And then we go back to be like, no, what about in here? And then it's like, oh yeah, this feels interesting. Or what about this voice? Like, this is an interesting texture of a voice for Mary Shelley. I like this. Okay, I'll put that up on the mood board. And then, you know, we'd send music to each other. We'd send poems to each other. We were painting, like, with all the colors that were available to us. And it was such, and knowing that we already had gone on a journey together and we were speaking language from the get-go in that, it felt like, really, we just have to be bold, intentional, focused, but so alive. Mm. And we've got each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've really got each other in this. And let's just go and dream.
I
just want to say one thing about that. Is like, it would have been, I guess it would have been easier to make another movie like The Last Daughter, or you're talking about, you know, taking a big swing or whatever. It's just that this is the movie that was in me.
Yeah.
There wasn't really anything else I could do.
Yeah. And if but that's really interesting, because if, for example, you hadn't found a studio to do it, what would you have done? Would you have made it a lower budget level, or could you have let it sit in the drawer for a while?
I really don't know the answer to that. It created a kind of, it ignited something. It started to, and you can feel it. You can just sort of feel it with a project when something like can't get off the ground or like it's just even things I've attached myself to as an actress where you're like, oh, I sort of want to do this, you know, and then you feel other things where it's like just starts to catch flame. Yeah. Yeah. And this one had that energy.
100%.
Yeah.
Like it was an extraordinary read and actually didn't change from much. It didn't change much from what we read. And you could feel, I mean, look, you do not get these level of artists coming around this piece if it doesn't have substance. This was like so full. It was so full and so new. And I think these kind of offerings are very rare, you know, to have a bold new perspective, to have a new language, to take a risk, you know, not to create something out of a habit in film, but actually to make something epic that is an original new language. And you don't get somebody like Christian Bale, Sandy Powell, Nadia Stacey, Warner Brothers. You don't get that. They're not going to come towards those things. And we all did with our hearts in our hands. And we're like,
but I know it's a little scary. I know it's new. It's new. And I know that. That's the feedback I just keep getting back sitting in this room all day, is that it's new. And that can be very exciting. And it can also be scary for people, you know?
But at the same time, I know we got to wrap up, but at the same time, I love what you're doing. I love the way that you're playing with the iconography of Frankenstein throughout the years as well. You know, obviously the nods to Elsa Lanchester, but also putting on the Ritz. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to ask real quick about that because that was, I just adored that. Where did that idea come from?
It came from Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, yeah, but so to nod to that was really,
of course, really definitely. But you know, we were talking about this the other day. I love Young Frankenstein. It's a wonderful movie, but I actually think somewhere the reason why I wanted to put that in was because of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. Like another epic love story. Yeah, like this one, you know.
Oh, my God.
I love that.
I'm really nearly tearing up. That's amazing. I don't know what the fuck happened there. Anyway. Maggie, Jess, it's been amazing. Thanks so much, Lynn. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Feel the love.
Hey, Sal.
Hank, what's going on? We haven't worked a case in years.
I just bought my car at Carvana, and it was so easy. Too easy.
Think something's up?
You tell me. They got thousands of options,
mm-hmm.
found a great car at a great price,
uh-huh.
and it got delivered the next day.
It sounds like Carvana just makes it easy to buy your car, Hank.
Yeah, you're right. Case closed.
Buy your car today on Carvana. Delivery fees may apply.
Okay, that was Maggie Gyllenhaal and Jesse Buckley talking about The Bride! Exclamation mark, and we will be reviewing that later on in the show. But right now, it is time to dig deep into this week's movie news.
So, Game of Thrones movie is in development, and what's even better is Bo Willimon is writing it. Apparently.
He of House of Cards and Andor fame.
And Andor fame, exactly. So, that's promising. It is also a prequel. Part of Westerosi history that we haven't seen yet. The story is it's maybe Aegon's conquest.
Aegon?
Maybe. But they maybe. Haven't confirmed, have
yes.
they? We just know it's a prequel.
So who's
That's
making
reports.
This? Which studio is making this?
This, will it be Warner Brothers?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
Are they making it quickly? So, okay, I'm very confused. I didn't know this was happening. So they've announced a Game of Thrones prequel movie that will be theatrically released or is going
to
be on
HBO Max? I
think
they've gone into details, to be fair. But also, none of that matters because whatever they announce, it will be up in the air because of probably the next thing we'll talk about.
This is the kind of thing that doesn't tend to get nixed by mergers, for example, which is what we're talking about, because it is a big IP that people seem to be into, and this is a big deal.
Merger.
I was going to do that, and I restrained myself.
So look, it's very early days, and we all know that Game of Thrones stuff has been announced before and hasn't happened because the script wasn't in good enough state.
Indeed.
So that could still happen. But assuming this has some legs and ideally wings and scales and fire-breathing ability, then we could see, for example, Aegon's conquest, which would be
very
cool. So basically, this is the first of the Targaryen kings who brought dragons to Westeros.
Yes.
Okay.
He came over from Old Valyria and set the whole of the Seven Kingdoms on fire.
Well, that's not very nice.
Pretty much. With his two sister wives. Yes. Both words.
His sister wives?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So he's from Port Stewart.
Oh, hey. Come on now. You're from Banbridge, dude. We are much
home of Game of Thrones, I'll have you know.
Barely.
And the Brontes. Definitely. We can lay claim to both of those. Anyway. Yeah. This sounds exciting. Question mark.
I know you're a huge Game of Thrones
Love it.
Fan, Chris.
Big fan.
It could be good. I think it's potentially interesting because these are real big dragons and I'm here for anything involving real big dragons.
Yeah.
I don't know how they'll deal with, you know, quite so much incest on the big screen. But, you know, it's baked into the concept of the land,
they handled
I guess.
It quite well in the main Game of Thrones, right? That's quite incesty.
It was.
What's this adapted from?
George R. R. Martin's brain.
Essentially. No, but he has written basically a fake history of Westeros, which is what House of the Dragon is based on.
And
House of the Dragon is based on a segment of that, which is about, 100 years after, a little bit more, 100 years after the conquest and 150 before our Game of Thrones main timeline.
Right.
So there's loads to adapt on either side, which is obviously what they're now doing.
Okay.
With everything else.
All right. Do they have a director? Or is it just
Bo
Willimon
just
writing it at the moment? And,
yeah, he's just sitting there playing with little dragon models, probably going, grrr, arg.
This is how Helen would do it.
100%.
Yeah. The thing we were referring to, merger, is that this is a Warner Brothers property because it is on HBO. And as you may know, a couple of months ago, it looked very, very likely that Warner Brothers was about to be acquired by Netflix, who were in competition with Paramount, who have recently, of course, been acquired by David Ellison, who's a billionaire with deep, deep pockets. And he wanted Warner Brothers. And then Netflix were like, no, we want Warner Brothers. And then Netflix won the bidding war. Or did they? Because last week they were blown out of the water by Paramount, who came back to the table with, I believe, it says here, technical term, oodles of cash. And now it looks like Paramount may be about to acquire Warner Brothers, although it is subject, of course, to scrutiny from the...
Oh, yeah. So much scrutiny.
It may not go through, because apparently it'll give them 40% of the market, and that's that's bad.
Yes,
but this is not a US government administration that is overly concerned with, you know, monopoly enforcement or anti-monopoly legislation.
Show you're working out.
When have they ever shown themselves to go against a monopoly? Anywho, I don't love this. I don't love any of it.
Whoever wins, we lose.
Yeah,
do we lose, though?
Yeah, we do.
I'm going to be glass half full again on this one. We're going to get loads of great movies.
Fewer movies, I would think.
I don't know. You know, Paramount have committed to making a lot more movies under this.
They have said they will, but realistically, when you consolidate two studios into one, I would say the output falls. It doesn't generally rise. So I would have thought we will get fewer movies. That said, Netflix wasn't a great fit either, because they don't really have a commitment to theatrical exhibitions. So it really was a kind of like, you know, we're fucked either way situation.
Why
can't
it just stay with Warner Brothers being Warner Brothers? Well, why do they need to sell? What's happened?
Yes, no, I mean, they're just attractive as a company, so people are trying to buy them. It's not, they can't...
They do want to be sold, though.
They aren't fighting these.
Yeah, the current head of Warner Brothers wants to sell, but that doesn't mean he has to. But, you know, the problem is, you know, the stockholders are going to just take the money and run, possibly literally.
It's all very exhausting. It feels like this is a film industry version of the board game Risk, with just very, very wealthy people running companies just playing around.
I think that's part of the problem. I think there is a you know, a freedom of speech issue about the overwhelming consolidation of media in the hands of a very, very small number of people. I think we have a healthier media ecosystem when there are lots and lots of smaller companies, but that time has gone. There was a diagram showing, you know, what percentage of the media market was owned by, you know, a number of companies in sort of the turn of the century, and now it's really massively, something like 90% of the media market is owned by like four or five companies. And this is that's not healthy, but it's not something that, you know, no one's going to stop it, and this is not the only symptom of it, I guess.
And also, I mean, look, can't, without pointing fingers at anyone, because who knows what's going to happen, but that's the problem. I mean, they can say what they want about what they're going to commit to and how many films they're going to produce and blah, 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 but we just don't know. We don't know how much of what Warner's do already is going to be retained in terms of working practices or theatrical windows or anything like that. Mm-hmm. We just don't know. And, you know, the different studios have different perspectives on what sort of films they make. Mm-hmm. You know, the question is, why are they hired? Do these people want to hire Warner's for financial purposes, for legacy purposes? I mean,
would David Ellison have made Sinners or One Battle After Another?
Well,
I think we should focus on the important issue here. And that's, if they mess with Dune, David Ellison, I will come for you. That's what I'm going to say.
Well, Dune is safe. Your third Dune film will come out before anything happens. Don't worry.
I mean, yeah, I think it's already been.
It's going to take a while anyway.
They will probably reboot it in 3 years' time.
Yes, if it happens, it's going to take a while. I am trying to be glass half full about these things, but it will most likely lead to many hundreds, if not thousands, of people losing their jobs as these two studios get consolidated. And that sucks. It happened when Disney took over Fox. And it may well happen here as well. But I am trying to be glass half full, and who knows? Maybe this will get, maybe they'll be more open to working with filmmakers. Maybe they'll provide a nice safe haven for filmmakers who want to tell stories. We don't know. We don't know. But yes, I can see why it would be tempting to be glass half full on this. Or even glass, oh no, it's smashed and it's gone everywhere and it's cut my wrist and no, and now I'm bleeding out.
Hey, speaking of glass smashed everywhere.
Oh, where's this going?
Scary Movie 6 trailer came out.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what? Before I press play, I was like, maybe I've been too hard on it. I remember those films. They came out, you know, I was younger then. I was happier. Maybe this will make me young and happy again. You know, mm-hmm. maybe I was too hard on them first time and maybe there was charm there. I mean, I like Regina Hall. I like some of the Wayans.
Like Anna Faris.
I like Anna Faris. Great. She's very funny.
Yeah.
It's so bad. I hated it so
much.
But
these films are hateful, aren't they?
Yeah, and now I think, now I remember, like, I hated them the first time, and now I remember why I hated them the first time.
I'm no friend of comedy, as you know, but I do feel that this particular vein of comedy that they, quote-unquote, mine for these films is the absolute lowest common denominator, and I detest it.
It's the sort of the way that they, like, replay entire scenes with the entire original dialogue, except for, like, putting in a fart noise or something.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I just, like, that's not parody to me. It's not clever. It's not funny. And I just, I did despair slightly watching this. I was like, oh, I get that reference. Yes, I still hate it, but I get your reference. All right, let's move on. Anyway.
Alex, you up on the scary movie franchise?
I haven't seen a single one.
Haven't seen any of them?
Including, oh, what you're missing out on, my goodness.
Well, I just never saw them. And I may not.
I mean, I can't recommend them.
I've heard.
All right.
<Wow. laughs>
They're okay. They tail off badly after three. So,
and the start's pretty bad, and the middle ain't too great either.
I don't think, listen, I don't want to get into an argument, but I think that the first three have some high points. Some very good jokes.
Put that on the poster.
Yeah. But anywho, they're not sucker Abraham sucker levels of parody, but they're a hell of a lot better than the likes of Meet the Spartans and Epic Movie and things like that. But anywho, this one looks dreadful beyond belief. But we shall see. We shall see. Every day is Christmas Eve. But there was another trailer this week for something that is not necessarily a film, but is film adjacent because it's DCU adjacent, the DC universe. That's what it's called these days,
we
right?
I think so, yeah, we think so.
Which is over at Warner Brothers, and I'm sure James Gunn is watching the merger with great interest as well to see what happens with that, because the trailer is for Lanterns, which is a new limited series following the adventures of two Green Lanterns. Hal Jordan, played by Kyle Chandler.
Woo!
And John Stewart.
Not that one.
Not that one. Played by Aaron Pierre. With his incredible eyes. Mm. His dreamy, dreamy eyes. What did you guys, and indeed Gal, make of this
Thanks
trailer?
So much for including me.
Thank you. Well, International Women's Day.
I thought it was dreamy. I mean, really promising. Like,
what do you think of the eyes, Helen?
Hey, my eyes are up here.
I mean, no, honestly, it just looked really interesting. It looked a little bit different to what we've seen before. It had a good energy. I really love Kyle Chandler and Aaron Pierre. I'm super here for that.
Do you think they could have got two attractive guys to star in this, don't you think?
What a shame that they could only get Chex Notes, Kyle Chandler, yes, and Aaron Pierre.
These bums.
Also, very charismatic. Let's
yes,
if wildly we can, so.
No, they really are. There's a lot of charisma in this trailer.
Mm.
What's the story of this show?
That's a good question.
From the trailer,
it's not 100% clear. That said, it does feel like, certainly from the marketing material, they are veering away from the more comic book centric elements of
cosmic
it.
Cosmic stuff.
Yeah, like it feels more like, I think it's been compared to like almost like a slightly lighter True Detective type vibe of the two of them together.
Wow.
It looked like a buddy movie.
It didn't seem quite that intense to me that it was quite on that level. But yeah, right. It has a buddy element to it.
Yeah.
Sort of mismatched buddy antagonist. But
so like Hal Jordan like training the younger John Stewart is the idea, and they're investigating
exactly
a murder.
Indeed.
This is exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am hyped.
Yeah.
Mm.
Hyped. Jimbo, you hyped? You don't look hyped, I'll be honest with you.
I really, really like both Kyle Chandler and Aaron Pierre. So, yes, I am very excited to see it. The actual subject matter means very little to me, but they're great. So, I'm there.
Yeah.
It would also be nice to see Aaron Pierre doing cool shit for, you know, six episodes or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
We may well do weekly spoilers for that. We shall see. We are going to be doing weekly spoilers for Daredevil Born Again Season 2 whenever it starts dropping on Disney Plus at the end of the month. When is Lanterns on HBO Max over here?
August is the date on the trailer, whether that means it's here as well. I'm not sure. I think probably yes, the way HBO is going these days.
Yes. Soon to be Paramount Plus Max, I guess. Yeah. Who knows? But that is exciting. Before I do a big old squee, Lee Isaac Chung has departed from the Ocean's 11 prequel.
Creative differences.
Oh, no.
Yes. He was creative. They were different. This is a movie that's been in development for a long, long time. Margot Robbie is producing and starring in it. At one point, I think Ryan Gosling was also attached, but doesn't seem to be anymore. And at one point, Jay Roach was also going to direct this. And I think it was even coming close. I'd heard they were scouting for locations, and then it's just gone on the back burner.
Oh.
And now Lee Isaac Chung has left. Deadline have quoted it. Warner Brothers, soon to be Paramount Brothers, a spokesperson saying, this is an amicable split due to creative differences. So make of that what you will. Do you think we'll ever see this movie?
I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah.
But I am holding the faith.
Are you holding the door?
Hodor.
Hold the door.
No, we've moved on from Game of Thrones.
Oh, so. No. But there we go. I hope that happens. And Ocean's 14 is happening at the same time. But shall I do a big old squee?
Do the squee.
Here we go. Squee! There's a ghosts movie.
Hey!
A ghosts movie. If you don't know what ghosts is, avail yourself of this knowledge immediately. Ghosts is a tremendous sitcom on BBC One, written by and starring the original Horrible Histories crew, who then started writing her own stuff and made the likes of Yonderland, which was on Sky and which was brilliant, and the likes of the movie Bill about a young William Shakespeare. And then they made Ghosts, which was about a young couple who move into an old country house, Button House, and one of them, the lady, Allison, played by Charlotte Ritchie, has an accident, and that accident awakens within her an ability to see all the ghosts who live in Button House, and they are many, and they are played by Lawrence Rickard, Martha Howe Douglas, Jim Howick, Simon Farnaby, Ben Wilbond, and Matthew Bainton, who also write this show, and it is brilliant and funny and heartwarming and moving. And did I mention funny?
Yeah, you did.
And they're terrific.
They are.
It finished on BBC One.
Yeah, but I didn't love the ending, so I'm okay. I just didn't love it.
Okay.
I love the show.
Yes.
I even love the American remake, which is pretty
I've never seen it. I can't bring myself to, but you think good? Yes?
I think good. I had fun. Slightly different, but there's definitely some, you know, rewrites of early episodes. But I just didn't love...
Why not? What was wrong with it?
It just didn't feel right for them to, you know, leave the ghosts the way that they left them, I guess.
All dead.
All dead, yes. Yeah. I wanted them all brought back to life. No, I'm kidding. But I am very excited to have a film now and hopefully bring me some peace.
Yes. So they're all back. All the cast are back. Kyle Smith-Bino is back as Mike, who is Allison's husband. Lolly Adefope is back, as well as Kitty is another one of the ghosts.
Oh, she's amazing.
They're all back. Katie Wicks is not back because her ghost character was sucked off in series 4.
That is, of course, their phrase for going up to wherever, the afterlife.
Absolutely. If you are as a ghost, you move on to I presume heaven. Then you have been sucked off, and I'm looking forward to Helen. I'll be honest with you, on the big screen, to sitting down and watching a whole group of people being sucked off. It's going to be a lot of fun. But enough about the Game of Thrones movie. I'm so excited about this. It's called Ghosts, The Possession of Button House. It started filming last week. No one knew about it, except for the people who worked on it, presumably. And all the Ghosts cast coordinated an announcement about this on Instagram at the same time. It got people frenzied.
Yes.
It's such a delightful, delightful show. Alex is looking at me as if he wants to die. Alex, are you not a fan of Ghosts?
That's just your face. No, I really...
Very aggressive today. Aggressive.
I really, really like Ghosts. They're a brilliant gang. I mean, all of them are so funny and so distinct. Every time I see Simon Farnaby, it just as that character with no trails on, because he died having an affair, having sex. It really makes me laugh. They've got such great chemistry between them. You can tell that they vibe so well together offset and writing it. You can see they have such fun doing it. It is a really funny show. I am intrigued to know what a cinematic version of Ghosts is.
Because it's a pretty cinematic show, and there's a single camera, it's shot on location.
Yeah, but it's contained, and we've seen quite a lot of it, and I wonder why they've decided to do this rather than... I mean, they've done specials before.
It's a strange choice.
So, yeah, I wonder, is it going to cost more money? Are they going to, is it going to be like Only Fools and the Horses? Chris, are they going to go to Mallorca or something? Do you know what I mean?
I really hope they are.
Miami twice or to Hull and back. Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God.
So, I don't know what it is as a cinema proposition, but I really like those people. So I it will just be funny, which is good enough for me.
One word, flashbacks.
Well, they've done all their flashbacks, haven't they?
Yeah, but they can do it on a bigger scale.
Yeah. One word, plastics. Okay, shall we talk about movies? Shall we review movies, in fact? Let's talk about the films that are out this week in the multiplex and indeed on the Sofaplex. Where do you want to start? We have three movies we're reviewing this week. We got Hoppers, we got The Bride, and we have Peaky Blinders. Why am I doing that accent?
Yeah, they're not from the West
Where
Country.
Are they from?
Have you seen it, Chris? Ever?
It's more Broadchurch.
No, that's what they've done for the movie.
If I'm completely honest with you, Alex, no, I have never seen Peaky Blinders.
No, I could have guessed that.
But I'm aware they're from Birmingham. That's an accent. As you know, I'm a chameleon. But the Birmingham accent eludes me. James, you went to school, big school.
In Birmingham.
In Birmingham. See? James, he's got it. He's nailed it.
I did live there for 3 years.
Okay.
And my dad's from Birmingham, so.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. Mm. James, give us another sentence in Peaky Blinders, please.
Right. Got to review the Peaky Blinders. I can't because I haven't seen it.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Pretty good.
Yeah. Better than yours, Chris.
What do you mean?
Oh, my God. That was like if Arnold Schwarzenegger lived in Birmingham for 5 or 6 years.
I've only been to Birmingham twice.
Have you?
I didn't have time to absorb the accent.
Yeah, and you don't pronounce the G when you say it either. You call it Birmingham.
Birmingham?
Birmingham.
So, really?
That's what you say when you say you go Birmingham.
Do I say that?
Yeah.
Well,
do it again.
How's it meant to be pronounced?
Say it again.
Birmingham.
Yeah. It has a G in it.
I pronounce
there
a G.
There was totally
Birmingham.
A G there.
Birmingham.
It was a little G, but it was definitely there.
Are you sure?
Yes. Alex.
Yeah.
Review, please, for us the Peaky Blinders movie, which is entitled The Immortal Man, and sees Chex Notes, Cillian Murphy return as Chex More Notes, Tommy Shelby, who is the chief of the Chex Notes Peaky Blinders organization in Chex Notes, Birmingham.
Sorry, didn't you ask me to do it?
Yes.
So this is the big screen version of the series that ended in TV terms on season 6. It's been very popular. It's mostly been very good, about this gang of ne'er-do-wells in Birmingham in the 1920s and 1930s.
Yeah, it started about 1919, didn't it?
1919, yeah, the end-ish of the First World War. So Stephen Knight, who created and has always written the show, has written this, and it is directed by Tom Harper, who directed some of the early episodes of the show. So we find
also Wild Rose.
Yes, that's true.
Jesse Buckley,
I'm just saying.
Oscar-bound.
Don't jinx it.
Don't jinx it.
We find ourselves for this film in 1940. World War II has broken out. It is not here to make friends.
All right.
Oh, I don't know if I can do this. Birmingham is being absolutely blitzed, which is the perfect environment for lots of people with little sense of morality to run amok, which is basically what happens in this film. So the series did finish with season six, with this film promised to be on the way. And that finished with most of the people that Tommy Shelby has ever associated with being dead, friends, family, enemies. For the whole series, he's suffering from PTSD and just trauma from World War I. And so at the end of season 6, he rides off on his horse to get away from that life and go and stew in his own trauma and depression and misery. That is where we find him for quite a long time in this film, where he's now retired to a ramshackle country pile so he can be all broody and grumpy and mopey and just shut himself off from society and feel all guilty and be antisocial and just feel sorry for himself. That's quite a large part of the first half of this film. And he is definitely not going back to Birmingham ever again or back to that life ever again. Absolutely not. And definitely not in this film, except that's obviously what this film is. So we meet quite early on his son, who we haven't met before. as Barry Keoghan, would you believe, playing a bit of a nasty little bastard.
Shifty Barry's back again.
He's very shifty in this film. He's now with Tommy Shelby gone, the Peaky Blinders are now under the leadership, if you can call it that, of Duke Shelby, a.k.a. Barry Keoghan, and the gang is now like a rampaging bunch of hoodlums with no rhyme or reason. They're thieving and looting and shooting and just terrorising people in Birmingham. And it's left to Sophie Rundle's character, Ada, who's Tommy's sister, to say, is this right? Should he be doing this? And don't know what Tommy would think of this. Meanwhile, Tommy is in his mansion going, no, I'm not going back. Word comes to him that his son is being a little bastard and the Peaky Blinders have been left to rot. And he's like, no, I'm not going back there. I've done it. I've fucked up enough. I've fucked up myself. I've fucked up everyone. I'm not coming back. I'll leave it up to you to decide whether he comes back or not, but he does. We also meet the antagonist of this film, who is a guy called Beckett, played by Tim Roth, who's essentially a bastard British person working for the Nazis. The plot is, he is charged with flooding England, the UK, with counterfeit money to supposedly collapse the economy so that Germany can win the war.
Yep.
So the question this film poses is, can and will Tommy Shelby return from self-imposed exile and win World War II?
Essentially,
that
yes.
That is literally the plot.
All right.
Okay. Did I enjoy this film? Yes. But you may have noticed the title of this film, The Immortal Man. It's not interested in subtlety. It quite enjoys its massive mythical allusions. It gets very caught up in its own mythology. It is very, very silly. And as entertaining as it is, I am not sure how self-aware it is. When I was watching it, I was like, it's not silly with a nod and a wink. It's just very bombastic,
yeah,
very big, very, very simplistic. That's the thing. So this is a movie, and it looks like a movie. It sounds like a movie. It's got a movie budget. But I felt like it does, over 100 minutes or so, what would be much more fleshed out and deepened and more complex over 6 episodes. They've always had their political plots in the TV show. And this one is the silliest they've done, and it's dealt with very quickly and not with much political. It just didn't really work for me on that scale. It's trying to be really, really bloody epic, which it is on a superficial level. There's not a lot of substance there. It's very predictable. It's pretty rote. And I wish I'd given a shit about what happened in it. You know what's going to happen. Everyone in there is having fun. Everyone, maybe not Killian, because his character is not allowed to have fun.
No.
But everyone else is really chewing the scenery. Tommy's just kind of depressed, but he does come back and, you know, kick some ass. If you enjoy the show and are fine with all of these things I'm saying, which the show is certainly guilty of, and you don't mind the endless PTSD and the posturing and the murder and the monologues and the endless needle drops, and this film really does have incessant needle drops, then maybe you will enjoy it. It is enjoyable, but it's very, very silly, and I thought very thin.
Yeah. If you're a Fontaine's DC fan, I mean, couldn't do better. I feel like if you cut out all the shots of people striding forward with their heads down under their flat cap, you could cut this down to about an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah, especially as they're all slow motion.
But unfortunately, all those shots are the best thing in it. They look fucking cool. Like, they look really, really good. Cillian Murphy in a well-cut suit and a cap. Yes, 100% on board. But yeah, everything else, you know, just as Alex said, really, it's a lot of moving and shouting and portentous lines without a lot of weight behind it. But it does look cool. I don't remember the show, and I haven't seen all of it, but I don't remember it being quite so into ghosts and sort of almost magic and prophecy and all that kind of thing. Because we haven't really talked about Rebecca Ferguson's character, who's like a...
Mm. Rebecca?
Gypsy prophetess type.
It
takes her quite seriously as a plot and as characters. You know, ghosts are almost more real in this film than they are in Ghosts. And I thought that was...
It's a sentiment
weird
that I think has been in the show, but not to the size.
Extent.
And it is very silly. It does. I think that's the problem. It does seem to take itself very seriously, and it's just not serious.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a single second of a TV show repeat to fade that chorus. But I enjoyed this. I thought, you know, it's pretty accessible for people who haven't seen everything.
Yeah, because they tell you all the time during the film what happened in the show.
It takes you by the hand. It's fairly simplistic at the end of the day. It's something bad is going down in Birmingham, and this man who has removed himself from the Birmingham criminal life needs to come back and sort shit out. And if that means winning World War II along the way, I quite like that. I quite like the scale of this thing. I quite like that Tim Roth is a despicable Nazi.
And has no shades to him whatsoever.
Yeah. It kind of had me from the opening couple of minutes, which is set in Germany in this train station, and you have this pounding guitar-driven soundtrack and lots of steam trains. It's not the movie I thought it was getting at all. And it's something that's a World War II movie. And I was like, oh, okay, I like World War II movies. I'm good. And then Tim Roth says an outrageous opening line, which we won't repeat here. And I was like, okay, you've got my interest. And I was on board for the rest of it. I think it could have done with a little bit less of Killian moping around his mansion, being moody.
It's a lot of it.
And a little bit more of him moping around Birmingham, being moody, but also kicking people in the face. Yeah. I think that might have been a little bit better.
The scene of him sort of coming back
is very cool.
Was very cool.
Yeah. I mean, they do it well. It is silly. They do it well. It sounded amazing. It looks very cool. There are some great lines in it and there's some good action. It was just so silly. Yeah. And by the end, I was like, come on.
The thing is, everything, I have not been able to see this because I wasn't able to make any of the screenings, which I'm devastated about because I love Peaky Blinders. But most of the complaints you have, Alex, seem to apply broadly to the show as well in the best way. Like, a lot of things that you don't like seem to be the things that I do like about the show. So I'm still very excited to see this, despite the fact that you didn't enjoy.
I've seen much of the show, and believe me, it's more subtle than this, but anyway.
All right. Well, this sounds like it's going to be fun to get into in the spoiler special. I'm going to be part of that because I think it's important to have someone who knows not what the fuck they're talking about. In that, we've done interviews already with Tom Harper and Stephen Knight. That'll be going out after it comes out on Netflix, folks, because it's in cinemas this week and next week. And then it's going to be on Netflix as of March the 20th. And we're going to be doing a spoiler special after it hits Netflix. But in the meantime, Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man, is in cinemas right now. And we gave it 3 stars. 3 stars in for The Immortal Man. Next up, The Immortal Woman. Hells Bells, tell us about Pixar's latest Hoppers.
Hurrah! Yes, this is not to be confused with the delicious Sri Lankan pancake called a hopper. This is kind of what if Pixar did Avatar a little bit, but of course they remind us it is not Avatar. The idea is that a young environmental activist who is voiced by Piper Curda learns that someone at her university has developed these robot animals, and you can put your mind in these robot animals and essentially pilot them around. And she decides to.
And this is nothing like Avatar.
It's nothing like Avatar. She decides to put her mind in the body of a beaver. Stop it. And
she doesn't decide.
But she, you know, she's in there interested in this technology. And she basically is going to try and use this opportunity to bring the beavers back to the little piece of, you know, parkland, the glade where she is to spend time with her grandmother, and try and save it from developers under the auspices of the town mayor, who is voiced by John Hamm. So you have a sort of setup which is explicitly environmental, explicitly sort of anti-capitalist, which is kind of unusual for Pixar to be quite this open, I guess, about their politics. But anyway, she befriends the King of the Beavers, voiced by Bobby Moynihan, really, really well, loved him. And sets about trying to bring the animals back to the glade and find out why they'd gone in the first place. I was not convinced by the trailer of this. I was hesitant. You know, I don't particularly love animated films about talking animals. That is like my least favorite genre of animated movie. But this completely won me over. To the point where, like, first half of the film, I'm like, haha, that's funny, haha, that's funny. And it kept happening more and more, you know, often as she got in with the animals. And it is just a really good comedy. And also in the sort of, by the second half and really into the last act, it just picked up and picked up and picked up steam and completely and utterly won me over. It is probably my favorite Pixar movie since the first Inside Out. On a par with at least Turning Red. Like,
that's,
I think,
11
it's,
years.
It's a while. Yeah, Turning Red maybe is the only one since that is close
Coco
to this.
We've had as well.
Remember me.
Okay, Coco was good, but I admired Coco. I'm not sure I loved it as much as I love this.
I love Soul.
I find this really, really charming, heartfelt, funny, moving, really funny, really, really funny.
I think, in a way, you've undersold how fucking insane this movie is.
Oh, it's batshit.
I I did a spoiler special with the film's director, Daniel Chong, and the producer, Nicola Grindel. And I said, I guessed 10% of the things are going to happen in this film. Because I'm not going to say anything here.
No.
But there are things that happened in this movie. It's gone, oh, that was not on my dance card. I didn't expect to see that in this movie.
Yeah.
It's wild, Alex.
Yeah.
It is very loopy. Certainly there are things that I've never seen before in any movie.
Yes.
It is fun. I wanted more from it, personally. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I think of Pixar, I think of how emotionally affected I've been by my favorite Pixar films.
And
this was not one of them. I actually think it was a little bit too loopy. And actually, it starts off very movingly, I thought.
Mm.
I mean, it's just, I won't spoil it, even though it's in the first 10 minutes, but it starts off with a sort of a human relationship episode. And I was really touched by it. And I thought that was top tier Pixar. But then it drops that completely until the very end, really. And in between that and the end, it's just a lot of hijinks. And it's very entertaining. But I don't know, it didn't feel quite that Pixar-y to me. There was something about it that felt almost like, I could be watching a DreamWorks film here.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think that's fair.
That might partly be the sheer amount of comedy in this, I feel like, is much higher than the average Pixar. I do agree. I think the for me, that sort of emotional spine was there the whole way through, which is maybe one of the reasons I loved it so much.
Well, it's driving the plot without sort of
No, but like there are visual reminders of that thing, I think, that come back
there
and come back.
Yeah.
I do think it's really funny. I mean, there's a character voiced by Vanessa Bayer who is...
Yeah.
Off the charts, amazingly hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great voice cast. John Hamm is the mayor. They're all perfectly cast, I will say. It's a lot of fun. I just wish there'd been a bit more to it, because it's just Pixar films to me are a cut above just we're going to watch a fun escapade, which I think this is broadly what this is.
4 stars then for Hoppers. Next up, Here Comes the Bride. And who better to talk about the bride than a man who is very frank.
And held together entirely by steak.
That is absolutely accurate.
It is James Dyer.
I mean, you broadly speaking covered the
Sorry,
plot,
sorry,
this one.
Sorry. Chew slacker.
Gosh, no.
I forgot about that.
Absolutely not. I preferred Frank. I mean, this is, as you've kind of already said, it's like a punk retelling of James Whale's The Bride of Frankenstein. You know, I think Maggie Gyllenhaal said that she was, one of the things she didn't like about that film, she was annoyed that Elsa Lanchester's bride speaks what not at all, and is in it for, 3 minutes?
Mm.
And so this is very much an attempt to address that by kind of turning it into an undead Bonnie and Clyde. So it's set, as you said, in 1930s Chicago, and Frank is a century old, and he's lonely, so he finds Annette Bening, as you do, and she is Dr. Euphronia, and he asks her if she can create him a bride. And they find the body of Ida, who's a kind of gangster's mole, who's recently deceased, having been pushed down a flight of stairs, and they reanimate her. And wouldn't you know, she's also sort of semi-possessed by the spirit of Mary Shelley, because of course she is. And then they go on a kind of like a wild sort of rampage of crime. And she becomes a kind of almost like an icon, like this sort of iconoclastic emblem for people who are kind of rising up and adopting sort of the sort of facial discoloration she's got. She's got sort of a black blood spatter on her face, which gives her this unique facial patterning. They are, of course, being chased by two police officers, Penelope Cruz and Peter Sarsgaard, who I would argue you could excise from this entire film and lose absolutely nothing, because it does feel a little bit long at 2 hours and 5 minutes. But like, it's got some broadly good performances on it. They're not subtle performances. They're very, very over the top. And, you know, it's got some interesting themes buried in there somewhere. Kind of, it's about body autonomy and, you know, and sexual assault and male entitlement. I mean, there are so many scenes of sexual assault in this film that I thought it was wildly unnecessary. I thought the kind of feminist 101 stuff had good intentions, but felt very surface level. I kind of weirdly like this idea that she becomes this almost like feminist emblem, this sort of revolutionary, this sort of counterculture icon. I liked that aspect of it, you know, inspiring people to sort of rise up there. But then, you know, it lacks subtlety. There's a bit where she bellows "Me Too" multiple times on the screen. And it's just like, come on, what are you doing? So I don't have a problem with anything that it's trying to do. I'm just not sure that it is able to probably do it, because it's kind of, it's discordant, it's loud, it's obnoxious, it's full of conflicting ideas that kind of crash into each other. It feels like Gyllenhaal can't keep it on a single idea for more than 2 minutes before veering wildly off into another lane and changing gears. And as a result, I found it a very, very bumpy ride watching it. Mm. But more than any of that, I found it crushingly dull. And I was so bored. I was looking at my watch repeatedly during this. So I really, really struggled with it. Like, I think, you know, there's ambition here, absolutely. And I think she definitely had a distinct vision of something that she wanted to do. But honestly, to quote the bride herself, because she quotes a line from Melville all the way through, I would prefer not to.
Like, thinking about it since I saw it, I agree with all the things it's trying to say. I think there are things worth saying and things worth talking about and things worth building a film around. And I can see the ideas, you know, that went into this. But it is such a hodgepodge. It screams at you from almost minute one.
Literally.
Literally and figuratively. And I just find watching it just such a trial.
Mm.
Thinking about it after having watched it is better than the experience of watching it.
I agree.
You know, you're like, oh, the costumes were good. Oh, I did like what Christian Bale did with Frank. I really liked his energy. Yes, he's kind of gaslighting her and he is withholding crucial information, but he is otherwise a fairly benign, murderous presence, you know? And I appreciate that for him. I really like that energy. I thought, weirdly, Jake Gyllenhaal didn't convince as a movie star. Go figure.
I thought he did.
I just didn't think he had the right look for the 30s and or the right energy or something. He just felt like he had iPhone face. You know, that's a face that's seen an iPhone. It just doesn't work. I just really wanted it to end for so yes. much of the film, and I also looked at my watch. And again, it's nothing against any of the cast; they're all doing, you know, well, maybe apart from what I've just said about Jake Gyllenhaal, which was maybe mean. But like everyone else, you know, Annette Bening is a mad scientist. Great, that's, you know, weird casting. I love it. Jesse Buckley, but, you know, on an absolute tear, no major objections, but just, you know, I none of it really hung together. I mean, the Penelope Cruz and Peter Sarsgaard, they have a little dynamic, they have their own little subplot, but it's just so thin because there's no time to get into that. And yet it still takes up all this time, it feels like, and you're just like, oh my God, why are we just, what's going on? Where are we trying to get to here? Oh, I find it exasperating, honestly.
All style. Very little substance.
Yeah.
Leave it at the altar.
No, loads of substance, just all over the place, though. Just like it's just.
Well, substance is.
It's like a substance. It's like goo all over the place, you know?
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? Because it really, really goes for it on every level, possibly too many levels.
Mm.
And it has a lot to say. But I was thinking about it afterwards. On the one hand, it's got too much to say because it's got so many things it wants to say. And on the other hand, it's not actually doing enough. Because it's grappling with
everything is underdeveloped.
Yeah, it's grappling with too many things, including the supporting characters. I mean, James, you were talking about Peter Sarsgaard and Penelope Cruz's characters. It doesn't need them.
No, it doesn't.
And by the end, it was like, oh, well, we don't care about these people, and I don't know if we're supposed to or not. But I will say, Maggie goes for it. Everyone goes for it. I think, you know, Christian Bale and Jesse Buckley both really fucking go for it. Jesse is very good. The material that she's given is very full on, and dare I say, quite irritating at times, but she gives it. She really gives it something. And I loved Christian Bale in it. I really, really, really enjoyed Guillermo's Frankenstein, and I loved that creature design, and I loved that soulful performance. Mm-hmm. Jacob Elordi was incredible. But I did enjoy seeing a more traditional Frankenstein who looked like Frankenstein and being played in that I'm a confused monster and I don't know how tough I am and I don't know what I'm doing and I'm lonely. Mm-hmm. He did it really well, and I don't think he was doing it cynically or with a nod and a wink. And the creature design was great. I mean, all the close-ups of how he was stitched together were quite gruesome, and I actually quite felt for him. But at the end of the day, it really made me want to watch Natural Born Killers, I've got to say. It really did, because I love that film. And feminism aside, this is doing a lot of what that film did. It's about these monstrous outlaws on the run who become a media sensation, and it plays with a lot of that stuff. But it made me want to watch a better version of this film. But I did really appreciate what it was going for.
2 stars then, sadly, for The Bride. Sad exclamation mark. And on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by Tim Ruff. That's a bit of Ruff. The star of Peaky Blinders, the immortal man. So he'll be on the show. Until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it is goodbye from my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Alex Godfrey.
Laters.
Goodbye, Chew Slacker.
Chew Slacker said nothing.
All right. Goodbye, James Dyer.
You should listen to the Pilot TV podcast. Why, Chris? Why should they listen to the Pilot TV podcast?
Is it because Kurt Russell and bloody White Russell are on it? That was all right.
I mean, it was Veering Scouse, though, wasn't it?
No, it was not Veering Scouse.
It seems
Veering somewhere. No, thank you very much.
They are on the podcast this week. That's yes. Absolutely true. But who else is on the Pilot TV podcast?
I don't know.
Chris?
You?
Who else? It's you.
Me!
You are on the Pilot TV podcast.
Yes! Finally, the Pilot TV podcast has been legitimized.
That's right. You were sucked off from the Empire podcast.
Oh, no.
Ascended.
I wonder what that
to
was.
The Pilot TV podcast.
Oh, no. Okay. And I spoke to the Russells.
You did?
Wyatt Russell and Kurt Russell. One's a dad, one's a son. I wasn't sure which was which, but I took a gamble.
Yeah.
Turned out to be the one with gray hair.
That's right.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. Anyway, that's fun. That'll be fun for the Pilot listeners to hear a good interview. It'll be an unusual yes. thing for them.
That's
They'll be
right.
like, oh, what's happened here? Sick. Good questions.
Sick wow. burn. Sick burn.
You opened the door. I went through it. It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to try and persuade Alex's mum to buy me heroin.
Sorry, mum.
Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.